Imagine a scenario where, you know, the very act of fighting to save your home, your family, or your civilization actually generates the exact supernatural fuel required to destroy it.
Right, like where drawing a sword in righteous defense literally feeds a god of bloodshed.
Exactly. Or where just hoping for a better tomorrow feeds a god of deceptive change. Today we are going on a deep dive into an incredibly detailed lore essay. It's titled A World Under Siege: How the Old World Lost Its War.
And it is such a masterclass in narrative stakes, really. We're looking at the world building of Warhammer fantasy today.
Yeah, the mission for our analysis is to understand the terrifying genius behind a setting where the defenders of reality are locked in a war that mathematically and physically they just cannot win.
I mean, the author of this essay presents a really compelling argument about the architecture of permanent tension. This isn't your traditional narrative where, you know, a temporary shadow falls over the land and heroes magically banish it.
Right.
The tragedy here is woven into the very tectonic plates and atmospheric pressure of the setting. The war for survival was effectively lost millennia before any of the characters we read about were even born.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to grasp the sheer scale of that doom, we have to start with the fundamental physics of this universe. We're looking at a literal geographic wound that makes absolute victory impossible.
Yeah, you have to look back to the world's prehistory for that. Roughly the year -4500 on the imperial calendar, to an event called the Great Catastrophe.
Right.
We know the world was originally visited by these godlike alien terraformers known as the Old Ones. And, you know, to facilitate their interstellar travel, they constructed these colossal warp gates at the planet's north and south poles.
And those gates suffered a catastrophic failure, didn't they? I mean, yeah. They didn't just break down and become dormant ruins. They ruptured the boundary between the physical dimension and the realm of chaos.
Exactly. And the realm of chaos is essentially a parallel dimension of raw, unfiltered, living magic. So when those polar gates collapsed, they basically created massive bleeding arteries pouring that dimension into the physical world. The lore refers to this ambient magical radiation as the winds of magic.
And it just constantly blows south from the poles, right? Like this endless mutating gale.
Yeah, precisely.
And where that magic pools up at the extreme north and south, physics simply ceased to exist. Like time distorts, the landscape mutates into this nightmare geometry, and demons physically precipitate out of the atmosphere like toxic rain.
Yeah, they call these regions the chaos waste.
It makes me think trying to put out a grease fire with water, you know, like the defenders of this world aren't facing a conventional invading army that they can just outmaneuver or outproduce.
No, not at all. What's fascinating here is how the source material treats chaos as a permanent structural fact of the environment. It is an ambient weather system of malice.
A weather system, yeah.
And the intelligence behind it, the four major chaos gods, they represent this profound psychological trap for the mortals living in this world.
Which is the ultimate catch-22 that the essay highlights. These gods are fed by mortal emotion, right? So you got Khorne, who is empowered by rage and martial pride.
Right, and Nurgle, who feeds on despair and the natural cycle of decay.
Sinich thrives on ambition, scheming, and just the desire for change in general. And then Slaanesh is fueled by any form of excess or sensory pursuit.
And the thing is, those aren't alien concepts. They're the fundamental drivers of a living, breathing civilization.
Exactly. The moment you clash swords to defend a besieged city, your martial fury feeds Khorne. If you try to invent a brilliant strategic countermeasure, well, your ambition feeds Sinch.
Yep.
The very emotional bandwidth required to resist the darkness just generates the ambient psychic energy that empowers the destroyers. I mean, to completely starve chaos, the world would have to become a lifeless, unfeeling rock.
Which creates an immediate logical dilemma for the reader. If the planet is constantly flooding with this chaotic radiation and the enemy is fueled by the mere act of resistance, how is anyone in this setting still breathing?
The essay points out that survival relies entirely on two desperate, degrading mechanisms acting as dams against the tide. Let's examine the first one, which is essentially the planet's dialysis machine.
Right, that would be the Great Vortex. It's maintained by the High Elves, the Asur, on their ring-shaped island continent of Ulthuan.
The mechanics of this vortex are staggering. You have this society of elven mages who have dedicated thousands of years to maintaining this swirling, magical maelstrom in the center of their continent.
Yeah, it functions as a cosmic vacuum cleaner.
Exactly. siphoning the excess winds of magic out of the atmosphere and venting it back into the realm of chaos. And if their concentration breaks, or if the vortex fails, the magical saturation on the planet reaches a critical mass, and demonic entities can just manifest in the middle of the street.
It's terrifying. And it requires immense generational sacrifice. The mages who weave these spells are exhausted, essentially burning their own lifespans just to keep the machine plugged in.
Wow. And there's a second dam too, right?
Yes. And it's even older, located in the deep jumbles of Lustria.
The Lizardmen and their leaders, the Slann. The Slann are these immensely powerful psychic beings created directly by the Old Ones.
Yeah. When the Polar Gates first exploded, it was the Slann who managed to magically cauterize the worst of the breaches.
But doing so cost them terribly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, half of their population was wiped out in that initial cataclysm alone.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you start to see the tragic motif of this universe. You have the High Elves, who are fundamentally a dying race with a declining birth rate.
Right.
And the Slann, a dwindling, irreplaceable order of minds. Both are just exhausted caretakers, rigorously following protocols and ancient plans left behind by absentee gods who are, frankly, never coming back to relieve them.
See, in a rational universe, if you have a cosmic leak threatening all of existence and two highly advanced civilizations sacrificing themselves to hold the walls together, the logical move is for every faction of order to unite and support them.
Logic, unfortunately, takes a backseat to pride and grievance here. The forces of order spent their most prosperous, powerful centuries systematically destroying each other.
The scale of the Friendly Fire is almost beyond comprehension. It begins with the elves during an event called the Sundering, around -2750 on the imperial calendar.
Right.
To repel an early demonic invasion, the first Phoenix King, Anarion, made the desperate choice to draw a legendary weapon known as the Sword of Cain.
And the mechanics of this weapon are crucial to understand. It isn't just a sharp blade. It is a sentient shard of the elven god of murder.
Oh, jeez.
Drawing it saved his people in the short term, but it irrevocably corrupted his bloodline, basically infecting his descendants with an uncompromising absolute capacity for violence.
Which brings us to his son, Malekith. Now, Malekith is a brilliant general and politician who firmly believes he is owed the throne of the Phoenix King. To prove his divine right, he attempts to undergo the sacred coronation ritual.
Which requires walking through the flame of Assyrian. The flame is meant to test the purity of the claimant's intent. It is a magical forge for the soul. And it completely rejects Malekith's sense of entitlement and underlying corruption. It burns him nearly to ash, leaving him the scarred, broken husk.
You know, any reasonable society might interpret a sacred fire stripping the flesh off a prince as a pretty clear sign he shouldn't be king.
You would think.
But Malekith, supported by his mother, Morathi, and a network of hidden cults worshipping Slaanesh, just refuses to accept the verdict. He sparks a catastrophic civil war.
A war that escalated to the point where Malekith's sorcerers actively attempted to unravel the Great Vortex.
Wait, really?
Yes. They were willing to unplug the planet's primary defense mechanism just to deny victory to their rivals.
That's insane. And the counterspell required to stabilize the vortex literally shatters the tectonic plates of Ulthuan, 1, sinking a third of the continent beneath the waves.
Just devastating.
Malekith flees, encases his burned body in magical armor, and founds the Dark Elves. This creates a permanent, cruel, slave-raiding mirror image of the High Elves. So the elves essentially bisect their own population in a magical workforce overnight.
And the cascade of self-sabotage continues from there. The Dark Elves eventually orchestrate the downfall of the greatest alliance the world had ever seen, the pact between the elves and the dwarf.
Historically, you had elven magical mastery paired with dwarf industrial engineering. It was an unbeatable combination.
Truly unbeatable.
But Dark Elf raiders, disguising themselves as High Elves, begin attacking dwarf caravans. Tensions rise, diplomats are sent, insults are exchanged in court, and it all culminates in the elves forcibly shaving the beard of a dwarf ambassador.
In the rigid, honor-bound society of the dwarfs, a shaved beard isn't just an insult. It is a profound cultural desecration. It is an unforgivable erasure of their dignity.
Wait, you're telling me the two most powerful civilizations in the world permanently destroyed their own golden ages, over a shaved beard and a misunderstanding?
Yeah, it's tragic.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I look at this from a real-world institutional perspective. I struggle to comprehend how two hyper-advanced ancient civilizations could commit to a 400-year sunk cost fallacy over an insult. They knew the threat of chaos existed.
It reveals something vital about dwarf psychology in this setting, though. For the dwarfs, their entire mental architecture is built on oaths and grudges. It is how they maintain order in a chaotic world.
Okay, that makes sense.
If they allow a slight of that magnitude to go unanswered, their internal societal structure literally collapses. They meticulously record every wrong in the Great Book of Grudges. So the War of the Beard, or the War of Vengeance, was mathematically devastating, but culturally unavoidable for them.
Wow. And the tragedy peaks when the Dwarf High King, Gotrek Starbreaker, finally kills the Elven Phoenix King in single combat. He takes the Elven crown as payment for the grudge, and the war ends.
But both empires are left in ruins.
Yeah. Their armies are decimated, their mountain holes are vulnerable, and their golden age is just dead. They crippled themselves.
And while the greatest armies on the surface were busy bleeding each other dry, they completely ignored the creeping industrial menace expanding directly beneath their cities.
Oh, right. We are talking about the Under Empire and the Skaven.
The Skaven are this teeming, subterranean civilization of humanoid rat men who worship a minor chaos deity called the Horned Rat. And their entire society and technological base run on Warpstone.
Warpstone is such a brilliant mechanical concept. It's not just a magical rock. It is solidified, radioactive chaos energy. The Skaven ingest it, they forge weapons with it, and use it to power their machinery. And their civilization is divided into highly specialized, deeply unstable clans.
Yeah, you have Clan Scryer, who function as mad engineers, building devastating sniper rifles and warp lightning cannons that have an extremely high probability of exploding and killing their own operator.
These are cool.
And then Clan Mulder utilizes Warpstone to violently mutate flesh, stitching together horrific battlefield monsters.
Then there is Clan Pestilence, who view biological decay as a religious sacrament. They aren't just spreading disease, they are literally weaponizing entropy. And Clan Eshin, who serves as the ultimate shadow assassins.
The sheer population density of the Skaven is terrifying. The essay explicitly notes that they vastly outnumber every other race combined. By all mathematical modeling, they should have overwhelmed the surface world centuries ago.
So what stops them?
Well, the mechanic that prevents this from happening is known as the Skaven paradox. They are governed by the Council of 13, but their defining psychological trait is absolute paranoid narcissism. Every single Skaven inherently believes they are the greatest being alive, surrounded by incompetent traitors.
So the moment a Skaven warlord is on the verge of a decisive victory against the surface world, the warlord standing next to him will invariably assassinate him just to steal the credit, thereby collapsing the entire campaign.
Exactly. Their own internal treachery is the only dam holding back that particular flood.
Which makes the response of the human civilization, the Empire of Man, so utterly fascinating. The Empire of Man officially denies that the Skaven even exist.
Right.
They have an entire subterranean empire of rat men mining beneath their cobblestone streets. And the state policy is to dismiss any sightings as uneducated peasant superstition or just mutant beastmen. Is this willful ignorance a coping mechanism for the humans? Or just another layer of the setting's dark comedy?
It really operates as a psychological shield, acknowledging that an infinite army of ratmen could collapse the foundations of your capital city at any moment. I mean, that would induce paralyzing societal panic.
Yeah, nobody wants to think about that.
So the human leadership chooses willful blindness to maintain order, even as it leaves them utterly vulnerable from below.
It's just layers of institutional denial. And as if the external pressure of chaos, the internal decay of the elves and dwarfs, and the subterranean threat of the Skaven weren't enough, the defenders of this world managed to create yet another permanent enemy.
We have to address the undead. Because unlike chaos, which is a cosmic anomaly, the existence of the undead is almost entirely the result of human ambition gone horribly wrong.
This brings us to Nagash. Nagash was originally a priest king in Nanakara, which serves as the setting's analog to ancient Egypt. He wasn't acting on behalf of a dark god. He was just a mortal transhumanist who became pathologically obsessed with curing death.
And through brutal experimentation, he essentially invents the science of necromancy.
Yeah.
He documents this dark science in his 9 black books. And during his experiments, he shares a corrupted elixir of immortality with Queen Neferata of Lamia.
Creating the world's first vampires. Every walking skeleton, every ghoul, and every vampire in the lore traces their lineage back to the ambition of this one man. Nagash is eventually assassinated, but the magical payload of his grand death curse misfires across the deserts of Nayakara.
And that misfire accidentally resurrects the Tomb Kings. Literally every mummified ruler of Nehekara wakes up. But unlike mindless zombies, they awaken with their memories, their egos, and their royal pride completely intact.
Which results in one of the most compelling characters in the lore, Setra the Imperishable. He is the supreme monarch of the Tomb Kings. When he wakes up to find himself a rotting mummy, rather than despairing, he just doubles down on his sheer arrogance.
Oh, absolutely.
His iconic rule is, Setra does not serve. Setra rules. He is so incredibly proud that he refuses to bow to the gods of chaos or even to Nagash himself.
This raises an important question about resource allocation in this endless war. Nagash's pursuit of immortality didn't just ruin a desert empire, it opened a permanent secondary front in the global war for survival.
Because centuries later, the vampires who originated from this magic, specifically the Von Karstein dynasty, they infiltrate the human province of Sylvania. Vlad Von Karstein and his successors launch wars that nearly conquer the Empire of Man from the inside.
So human armies, who desperately need to be marching north to hold the line against the mutating hordes of chaos, are instead bogged down in their own heartland, fighting their resurrected ancestors.
When you synthesize all of this, when you zoom out and look at the human heartland, you finally see the impossible geometry of this siege. Let's trace the map real quick.
Okay. If you stand in the center of the empire, look to the north, you face the chaos wastes. You have constant incursions of chaos champions and mutant beastmen roaming your own forests.
Right.
You rely on the northern human kingdom of Kislev to act as a brutalized first shield, but it is a shield that is slowly splintering.
And then look to the east and the mountain ranges. You have the greenskins, the orcs, and goblins. The mechanic here is that they are a fungal race. They reproduce via spores released into the ground, meaning you can never permanently eradicate them.
Never.
When their population reaches critical mass, they generate a psychic, self-sustaining war frenzy called a waw.
Yeah.
That just crushes everything in its path.
Then look below your feet.
Yeah.
The Skaven, an unchecked industrial revolution of warpstone-fueled rats, just waiting for the day they stop assassinating each other long enough to swarm the surface.
And look to your own graveyards. The undead constantly being weaponized by rogue necromancers or vampire counts. And underneath all of this, the ambient radiation of the winds of magic is slowly mutating the very laws of physics around you. It isn't a war. It is six overlapping wars of attrition happening simultaneously.
All being fought by an empire fractured by internal religious schisms and political rivalries.
So what does this all mean? If the world is mathematically doomed, if every victory is temporary and every defeat is permanent, why engage with this narrative? The essay makes a profound observation here that this relentless, impossible siege is actually a meticulously crafted engine for meaning.
Yeah, the setting strips away the comfort of a guaranteed fairy tale ending. By making absolute victory impossible, it forces the characters and the reader to focus entirely on the manner in which they resist.
Think about the archetypes this creates. A Bretonian knight embarking on an agonizing quest for a grail he will likely never find, knowing his flesh will fail long before his duty ends. A dwarf slayer, a warrior who has committed a sin so great he dyes his hair orange and actively seeks out an honorable death against an insurmountable foe just to balance the scales of his own shame.
Or an empire general standing on a muddy bridge in the freezing rain, holding the line for one more night against a horde of beastmen, knowing with absolute certainty that reinforcements are not coming.
They don't draw their swords because they think they are going to win the war, retire to a farm, and live happily ever after. They fight because the alternative, simply giving up and letting the darkness consume their humanity, is fundamentally worse than losing.
It perfectly distills the core philosophy of Warhammer fantasy. The defenders of the old world are not promised salvation. They only get to choose how they face their end. And generation after generation, despite the political corruption, despite the self-inflicted wounds, they choose to lose on their feet with a weapon in their hands.
It recontextualizes all the tragedy we've discussed today. Every elf or dwarf who dies over an ancient grudge, every human soldier killed by a vampire is a devastating loss because that is one less soul standing at the barricades when the true darkness finally arrives.
The essay leaves us with a hauntingly beautiful image to summarize this world building. The entire setting is fundamentally a guttering candle. The darkness is absolute, pressing in from every conceivable angle, and there is just a fragile, scarred hand cupped around the flame, stubbornly refusing to let it go out a single second early.
It constructs a narrative universe where every act of bravery is rendered infinitely more impactful, precisely because the safety net of a guaranteed happy ending has been removed. Which brings us to the end of our session today. We've mapped out a universe where the physics demand destruction, the caretakers are fading, the alliances are shattered by pride, and the very floorboards are teeming with ruin.
And the lore confirms that the end times eventually do arrive, the dams break, and all these deferred bills come due.
But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over, one that stretches beyond the lore and into our own lives. Why are we, as real-world readers, learners, and consumers of media, so magnetically drawn to these mathematically doomed narratives? Does placing fictional characters in impossible, unwinnable situations reveal something fundamental about our own human psychology? Perhaps it reflects our own real-world struggles to find purpose, build legacies, and cup our own hands around the flame in the face of our own inevitable mortality and entropy. Something to think about the next time you feel the darkness pressing in.
A truly poignant question to carry forward.
Until next time, keep asking questions.